This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ, sign up for our email list, and check out our website at amplifyrj.com to stay up to date on everything we have going on. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed on whatever platform you're listening on right now so you don't miss an episode. And finally, we'd love it if you left us a rating and review. It really helps us literally amplify this work. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives.
Hey folks, I'm your producer, Elise, and I am so excited to welcome Patricia Paz Zamora to our podcast today. Paz is an artist as well as the director for the Boys and Girls Club of San Francisco. She is also a leader in the Chicago movement for restorative justice. Today's podcast will feature conversations on restorative education in the criminal legal system, within families, and so much more. But before we get into this episode, I would like to invite you all to Amplify RJ's first birthday kickback on March 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. This will be a time to celebrate you and to celebrate all the growth and learning that has occurred over this past year. We also want to give you a chance to give your podcast reflections at tiny.cc/ARJ year 1. All of this information is in the podcast notes. If you have been enjoying this podcast, I would recommend checking out our YouTube channel where we have recently been putting out many different podcast clips in order to amplify this message on other platforms. Also, we have recently launched our Future Ancestor Collective, which is an amalgamation of community spaces, which can be found in the show notes below. That's all for our announcements, so let's get into this conversation.
David here. Before we get started, I wanted to give a heads up about the audio in this episode. As you'll soon hear, Paz was recording this in her outdoor art studio, so don't be surprised when you hear the occasional car driving by or other neighborhood sounds. It makes some parts of her stories a little difficult to hear, but that's just more incentive for you to listen extra close because this is a great conversation. Here we go. Welcome, Paz. Who
Hi.
Are you?
Healer.
Who are you?
Creative.
Who are you?
Trauma.
Who are you?
A leader.
Who are you?
A goofball.
Who are you?
A partner.
And finally, who are you?
Love.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We're going to get to know all of those different parts of you as we get to continue the conversation. But before we get going too far, it's always good to check in. So in the fullest extent, how are you?
Filled with gratitude right now in this moment.
Yeah. Any specific reason?
I'm sitting outside in my studio in the Central Valley with images of some of my work. I have a little altar in the back. I'm a Latinx woman, brown hair, short, with glasses and big earrings, white earrings that I got from Mexico, from the Huichol. I'm Mexican, and I'm wearing a black t-shirt that says Hilvi, and I have on these bright neon headphones. And I feel I'm at home right now on land that's been seven generations in our family.
Wow.
In the Central Valley.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing. you know, it's always good to talk to another Californian who's also spent some time in Chicago and now is back in California. So our paths mirror each other, although you were doing that all before me. I learned about you because your name was passed around in Chicago restorative justice circles as one of the OGs, one of the first people to bring quote unquote restorative justice into schools with the quote-unquote peer juries at SEN. But you know, you've been doing this work long before that, long before you probably even knew the word restorative justice. So in your own words, how did this work get started for you?
The OGs, the old grumpies. the old grown-ups. Okay, restorative justice has always been in me. And it got knocked out of me because of colonization and all the, you know, racism and institutionalized and systems. And so for me, it was reconnecting as a wounded healer, somebody who was trying to run away from what had happened in my own life by trying to help others. And I saw myself in those other young people, especially young people and women. And there was nothing wrong with that, but at a certain point, it got to a point where I had to go inward more than outward, but it's still connected. When I moved to Chicago, I've always worked in the community. I've always worked in the community ever since I was 18. I worked in a community center. I was always active in the organizing in Mecha, Emoja, and college. But when I moved to Chicago, I got involved with working at a place called Casa Aztlan, which was one of the oldest nonprofits started through the civil, the 60s. And the building was a settlement house, and it was taken over by mainly Latinx activists in the Pilsen community. And so I was there as a youth director. And I had a lot of really good intentions. I was working mainly with young people in the Pilsen who were gang involved, or just because of the neighborhood is so tight, you know, in Chicago, all the blocks on blocks and people hang out in front. I started to really feel it when, so I would go to court with kids, I'd go to school, I'd run the after school program. We work with the younger kids, we get involved with different stuff in the community. And I started to feel it when we started getting a lot of kids were getting shot and killed that I worked with, and not knowing what to do. And also, like, how do you heal that? And so I connected with Luis Rodriguez, who's my compadre. Him and my husband were roommates back in the day. They're both poets, but he's poet laureate of Los Angeles and just an amazing writer and his life experience. His son Ramiro, we formed a group called Youth Struggling for Survival. And basically, he started connecting with a lot of the elders, primarily in the American Indian community, as well as the Mexica community, which is a traditional word for Mexican, Latinx, Chicano. Also within the African community, there was one elder in particular that we worked with a lot, Baba Shange, who now has passed. And Michael Mead, who is Irish, but does amazing work, storytelling and community building. And so that's how we started. That's how I first came to know Circle, was because we brought young people together in their homes, actually, when we first had some of the shootings. And I remember this being in the Pilsen on 18th Street with maybe like 15 kids sitting in one of the living rooms with Luis and having a circle, because we know that that bullet had been going around in the community for ages and it was going to keep going. And how do we disrupt that cycle? And we did the circle. That's when then we started doing the circle with, you know, people from the different elders in the community. Also, we did the sweat lodge ceremony that the Temezcal brought together adults and young people around that healing practice, and then also the vision quest, which was done on land in Pine Ridge Reservation, one of the elders who's now passed. And I think the last one was we did this event called Red Noise, Ill Noise, and we brought over 100 youth from the Chicago Bay Area to Pine Ridge, and they did, it was like a conference and exchange, and really beautiful battling, like, you know, the jingle dancers and the hip hop and Brazilian. So that's how I knew it in community. And then later, when restorative justice became into the juvenile courts, I reconnected again, and that was a name that was given to these traditional practices that we had already been involved with in community.
Yeah, there's so much to pull out in there. I'm actually gonna ask you to go back even farther, right? What was it that had you decide that, you know, community is it for me, like from 18 years old?
I think at a very young age, I was politicized. In fifth grade, my sisters, they grew up during the 60s, all the unrest and protests and drug issues that were going on. And one of them in particular was, let's just say she was very radical in her politics in the Central Valley. And so she used to bring me literature around some of the radical politics, and I related to it. And I also was very, like, in fifth grade was going to translate for my dad who got disabled. You know, he worked in the fields and the factories. And I'm like, why is he's working so hard? And this is what they did after all these years. He, you know, stayed disabled. And so I got just that, the connection that I was part of a working class, that there was a class, that I was brown, that I knew that it wasn't right. Like, I ate burritos and tortillas at home, and I don't even use a fork. And in school, I was becoming ashamed of that. So there was all these things that kind of were like red flags, but as kids, you don't know. You're being assimilated, and your insides are being taken away, who you are, chipped away. And so I think just that and continuing to be really involved in politics in the community, and all kinds of politics, from Alinsky, restorative, to political, you know, influence of communism and socialism, politics, being in the Brown Berets, being exposed to all that. And I think that what made me pay attention to the work with Indigenous was I felt that was the first time that it wasn't all about out there. It was actually connecting more in here, because there were so many things that had not been healed in myself that it was almost hypocritical. I mean, that's one of the things about restorative practices is you start with yourself, and you're not doing it because it's good for someone else. It's actually good. I need this. I need circle. And if I can be in that in a good way, then that's creating an opening for others to be there.
Yeah. It's that, you know, if this work is about relationships, the first relationship you have is with yourself, right?
Yeah.
And then when you take care of yourself in Lakesh, right? Mitakuyasan, like, we're taking care the other. We're so interconnected. And so when, you know, you experience all this trauma growing up, trauma that the young people are experiencing in the neighborhoods that you're working in, what I heard you saying in your first answer was, you know, bringing in an Indigenous way, like, really helped you come back to, you know, restoring yourself, not just serving others. I think the first time you and I talked, you talked about, you know, so much when you were doing that work, you were burning yourself out, not taking care of yourself. And I think that's something that a lot of people who are doing community work or work for the people, how do you continue to navigate that balance?
Yeah. Well, I think, like, slowing down, and how do we slow down as a community? I just finished a 3-month residency with young Latinx, African-American young women, 8th grade through 17. And it was about adapting this curriculum of a group I'm part of. It's called The Place of Her Own, which is for BIPOC women, trauma to transformation. And it's the first time we've adapted it with younger women. And when we did the reflection about what, because it was during the pandemic when it had first started, and there was like, you know, just a lot going on. And the thing that they felt the strongest about was that they felt heard, they felt safe, they felt at peace. And it was all things around their own reflection as leaders, as young women of color who like have so much lived wisdom and experience, and also like just giving ourselves the time to like be with that, because there's going to be things coming up that the tendency is going to want to be to just jump in and fight. And sometimes we have to, but if it's like for me, just sometimes it was not in a good way, not in a balanced way. So I'm still committed to all those things. I'm still doing those things, but I think that eating right, sleeping, watching things that patterns that can be addictive that are not helpful. And it's just not about drinking. There's other things too. Be like, I play video games. I love playing video games. And I'm like, Patricia, what are you doing over here? Is that really the best way to rest? But yeah, I think being aware, slowing down, paying attention, and right now I'm working with the elder, and there's things I do daily that are practices in acknowledging things that are rising up based on old ways, and then releasing it. And it's a practice, and I do it, but you have to be still to do that. And before I was running all over the place, and now that's not who I am today.
Part of it is just lived experience and learning. You know, running all the time is not sustainable. But was there a specific moment or a series of moments that helped you make that shift?
When the pandemic first happened, I think, well, I decided not to go back to my job that I had for 14 years when I came back to San Francisco, and to take time off and to really go explore my own art, spend time with my mother, spend time with my partner, spend time with my art, spend time with my sisters, helping support them. Yeah. So that was like a major pivotal point for me, was to say, no, I'm not going to come back. Because, you know, during the pandemic, everybody was afraid, like health insurance, blah, 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 blah. So that was one. And that's taken me on a whole different path right now. But there's been moments being working for the Board of Ed when I left Alternatives after being a founding member of the peer jury program there. Mm-hmm. I decided to go into kind of the belly of the beast, and I coordinated for a year their Alternatives to Expulsion program for the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
But I only lasted a year. It's very, very, very political.
Before we get to that, like, I know some of these things, but everybody else listening doesn't have the context for that. So you had like encountered restorative, quote unquote, restorative justice back in the criminal legal system with the juveniles. And, you know, you started seeing the need for this in schools. How did that play out?
Yeah. So as you know, I don't know if Alternative still does this, but we used to run, it was based on the Beacon. It's called the YouthNet Center. So what it means is that around the city, there were spaces that a community organization would get a contract to run after school programming. And ours was at Senn High School and in the Edgewater community. And I was at that time working with young people who were referred to court, but then they, instead of like going into the juvenile detention center, they would have community-based alternatives. And so what I saw, because we used to run programming for little ones all the way to adults. So we would have like 600 members there. And we had parents coming in playing soccer and teenagers using, going for tutoring and younger youth going there after school. We'd do walks from the neighborhood schools and bring them all there. And what I noticed was that some of the teens, I used to be also the youth program, the teen director. So I got to meet a lot of young people who were doing all kinds of stuff, but the ones especially who were being struggling or getting more pushed out, what would happen is they would be suspended from school, and then they would be hanging around after school at school at YouthNet. And I would ask them, like, what's going on, you know? And just talking with them, it was really obvious that if a young person is struggling in school and they're not going to school because they're a young mother, their home life is very unstable, they're more caught up, let's say, with the street life. If you're suspending them for days, they're actually just giving them more chance to get in trouble, because now they don't even have connection with adults in school who care about them. And there's all these punitive things that are being done that don't really connect with the root of like their lives and like what's going on. And so I started talking with some of them, and I ended up going to this conference. It was an international conference, and there was this judge there who was doing the peer jury program in Los Angeles. And so there was models of that developing in Chicago as well. And so I took some of the youth with me, and I asked them, what do you guys think about starting something here at the school where, you know, just listening to your stories, what would it be like if you had other youth to talk to with adult support that could help you maybe figure out another way? And we already had a conflict resolution program at the school, so there was a path there. So I had about a group of about maybe 10 committed youth, and some of them, the youngest one was an eighth grader who was just all over the place, but he was so good. You know, he just had he's an eighth grader, but he was like one, a very dedicated member. And so we just started looking at the videos that were out there. We visited all these other places, and I never heard restorative justice, but I didn't like there. I went to one peer jury, and the youth were all sitting on a stage, and the youth had to come and stand in front of them. And of course it's good to take responsibility, but it was very just kind of mimicking what adults do.
Right.
But young people
power and over not, like it's yeah. just that my peer has power over me, not that it's an adult.
Yeah. So we kept tweaking it, and we said, no, that's not. And I would say, how did that make you feel? And if you're going to set something up here at your school, what do you want other students to feel? So we kept morphing it. We did it first where everybody's sitting at a table and the youth would sit there in front of them. And then we made a square. Then we got a circle. But when we got restorative practices, it was a good way. We were able to name then, like, this is more aligned. And then we stopped calling it peer jury at some point, because even judging. So it went through, we didn't know what we were doing, but we just kind of knew that we had to kind of listen to what felt right. Where could young people have us help be in space to share what's really going on in their lives? And then what other resources or people could they connect with to help them do what they needed to do? So kind of that's how we got started. And then we started at SEN, and just real quick, the courts were looking for models of like Aura, CJYI, mm-hmm. Community Justice, I can't remember,
for Youth Institute.
Yes. So that they were one example, victim impact panels and peer jury. Mm-hmm. And so we started going all over the city talking about what we were doing, and we formally adopted restorative practices. And then we got a approached. I got approached through Chicago Public Schools. Well, the court did, and then they came and talked with us, and we ended up taking it to 24 high schools. And because I was the only staff working at the time, what I did was form an advisory committee, and all these people came on, you know, heavy hitters, all these people who never necessarily had the same approach, but they really wanted to be in the schools because this was like a big opportunity to really get in there and make a difference. So we had an advisory committee, and we would train in the curriculum, but it was very emergent. And then we would add in what other people did. We were like always adapting it. And then we would, and sometimes when we start circle, I mean, we would have like 200 people in circle, in this big circle, opening and closing circle. And we learned a lot. And then there were people who came after me who like took it to a whole nother, Christina, Karen, Sandra, yourself. I'm sure there's many others that evolved it as restorative practices got more known, and we had more practitioners in the community.
Yeah, you transitioned out of your role at Alternatives, like you were saying, into like one with Chicago Public Schools specifically, mm-hmm. right? And then since then, you've been working with primarily with the Boys and Girls Club, and in the Bay Area, right? The restorative justice scene is also very, very active. You've been one of these people who's been bringing this work in for, you know, the last 20 years. How have you seen it change and evolve over that time?
Mm-hmm. I think definitely it's more known. And I think that there is more of an awareness now of, like, one of the whole conversations that I was part of, because I was in circle with other elders, was that we have to acknowledge the roots, and it can't just be this glossed over, like kind of like how some people do around land acknowledgments. It's like, check this box, but let's really like honor and bring those elders into the restorative practice. And let me get back focused again. Sorry, what was the question?
It was, how have you seen this work evolve in the last 20 years, specifically in schools? But
yeah, I think just making sure that we really properly acknowledge the ancestral traditions, and that it cannot be just checking the box, because we are still alive and we are still here. And for me, it was very important for young people to know, like, and for me to know, that when we acknowledge these ancestors, we're part of those ancestors. Right now, we are part of this circle. I think that's the main thing, is like really being authentic. It's just like, even sometimes things come out of like crisis. And I think the schools were really in crisis. Chicago Public Schools was like under the heat, because so many young people, especially Black youth, were being pushed out, and they had to have another way. But would they have done it on their own if it wouldn't have been under so much heat? Maybe yes, maybe no, maybe to what extent. But I think more people are there for the right reasons. And to me, this is not a program, it's a way of life for many. And also, it's not about, like, I do this with my own family, and it's not about funding. It doesn't take any funding to be restorative. But we do need training and we do need programs, but I sometimes get afraid of it becoming also very, it should be part of the system, but also it has to be, for me, I don't know, authentic. I don't know, maybe if that's being too judgmental.
I mean, whether or not it is, we'll let the listener decide, right? Yeah. But I think one of the things in there is that, you know, as you're talking about this being a way of being, about restorative justice or our ancestral values of interconnection, right?
I love that.
Taking care of each other. That's a way of being that is in direct opposition to the construction of public schooling and schooling in general, making a difference between like education and learning and schooling, right? And so schooling asks for programs to do to these bad, quote-unquote, bad kids, right, to fix yes. them. And actually, in my conversation with Sandra, I shared something that, like, I don't think I had put together in my head before. Like, there are some people who come to this work from a perspective of, like, these are our ancestral ways. Let's live at these values and take them with us wherever we go. And there are people who identify, like, there's something wrong with this white supremacist, racist system. And like, what is the practice that we can use to fix it, right? There's not a practice to use to fix this when this is all wrong. We need yeah. to embody this way of being. And like, that way of being is actually going to break this system if we do it right, if we do it well. And
I love that. I love that. I just want to say, I love that. And please keep going. And I just want to add in, it's not a magic wand. There's a lot of other systemic work. Yeah, but I just wanted to throw that in there as you were sharing.
Yeah, no, because as you were saying, like doing this work within your, just even within yourself and within your family, that's hard work. When you try to bring it to a classroom, right, of 30 people or a school staff of 30, 40, 50 people, it's even more challenging. And so to say like, hey, we have this peer jury program where the bad kids get their problems worked out, and the rest of the school hasn't embraced this way of like proactively building relationships and taking care of each other, we're not going to get to the results that we wanted. Just because you sit in a circle passing a talking piece doesn't mean you're acknowledging the people around you for their full humanity, right? And really yeah. doing what's best. And that, you're right, that doesn't take money. It takes time and intention. And I think one of the things that gets in the way of people giving that time and intention is the way that, you know, we've been socialized to value, like productivity and results over, the people and the process. And now I'm just calling back to like the conversation with Tema Oken and talking about characteristics of white supremacy culture, but it's all here.
I love that. And actually, I don't also want to minimize resources and funding. Mm-hmm. There's so many police at that time that were in the Chicago public schools and not, you know, I'm not going to, but why won't they have fully trained circle keepers mm-hmm. and people paid to do that? You know, that there has to be an investment in these type of resources in ways, because, you know, those other investments in the prison system and so forth, you know. So I'm not also saying there shouldn't be resources and priority given to these other healing systems have mm-hmm. to be created.
Yeah, I think like you're right, like not to minimize the funding at all. And when we're saying it takes time and intention, part of that intention is like, instead of funding a salary for an SRO, we're going to fund a salary for another counselor, another person who can provide healthcare. You know, like do we need to supplement our food program because kids coming to school hungry, like, aren't going to be in the best mood. And so when somebody snaps at them, they're a whole lot like more likely to snap back. There are all these other ways that resources can be channeled, intentionally meeting the needs of folks, not just keeping property safe, right?
Right, that's right. Well said. I love listening to you talk. It's like, it really makes sense. And I love the language that I'm learning from you in terms of just the expression. It's really appreciated. So I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Well, thank yeah. you. It's a gift yeah. to have these conversations with you and others that continue to challenge me and help me think. And then we get to share them with other people. And so thank you for being a part of this as well. So you've been doing this work in schools, and then like you moved out of Chicago. I don't know how much you want to get into the politics of what was going on in there. And to San Francisco, working with a Boys and Girls Club, largely doing this work through art. Mm-hmm. Why the transition and what did that look like?
Yeah. So I left alternative. I was at Alternatives for 10 years working with the restorative justice. We actually have founded a restorative justice department and really continue to build on that. And then I got this opportunity to apply for this position with Chicago Public Schools. And it was in the Alternatives to Expulsion, where it's the program right before youth get expelled. Mm-hmm. They do community service. It's character-based education program. And then they have the alternative high schools where young people would go, and then they would come back to their home school. So I decided to go with it. And that was very eye-opening because I think my focus in going there was to bring in restorative practice, to push the envelope on restorative practices. And so that was like the focus was to put restorative language into the different contracts with our vendors to make that be a filter, a consideration for how we're working with our youth. We were able to do CIRCLE, but I only lasted there a year because it got very political. And so I just took those lessons. But also at that time, my husband and I were going to come back because our mothers, mm-hmm. we both play a role of leadership in supporting them and our family. So came here, was a club director for 4 years in the Tenderloin. I don't know if you're familiar with Tenderloin.
No.
But they call it the containment zone in San Francisco. It's mm-hmm. kind of like what they call Skid Row. Mm-hmm. In Los Angeles,
yeah.
I'm putting that in air quotes. And I remember being interviewed and walking from downtown because it's right downtown. It's like the fancy smancy buildings. And then all of a sudden you're like, what the hell, what is going on? And so I remember walking into Tenderloin and there's like people laid out on the street, people open air market, drugs, just people in pain, you know, just out there on the streets, right, doing whatever. And that's the first club I was at. And it was a little tiny club. It was on the storefront of a Mercy Housing, which is all affordable housing. And I remember walking, and I'm like, huh. And so that's where I became club director. And I worked there for 10 years in that community. And I loved it because it was some of the most vulnerable communities in the sense of like elderly. There were so many kids there. People who were trying to stay clean, people who were using, people who were homeless, all kinds of, different community members. It's just all different, very, very diverse ethnically. Gender, lived experience. And so that was where I got to be club director. And I knew I wanted to bring in restorative practices, but I didn't want to push it because a lot of that time, energy in Chicago was really pushing for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we rewrote the school district code in Chicago Public Schools to preclude restorative languages after 10 years. But that was not the energy I wanted to do. That was kind of a healing moment. So what I did was with my own team that was there, the first week I started, we would go to, we called it the secret room. And it was on the second floor over the teen center. And I just told them, bring pictures of people that you love, bring things I want to know about you. And so we would sit in the afternoons and we would be in CIRCLE and people would, you know, we have our opening and we'd share and we would talk. We did that for a week. And then I said, this is something that's really important to me that I want to bring. It's going to be part of who I am. And I want you to understand it, but I know it's not the only way that we can get connected and respecting other ways, traditions that you will bring. And so we did recircle and we kept bringing it in little ways until we actually ended up winning a national award in Boys and Girls Club of America for that process. It was called the CIRCLE. They called it something else, but basically it was using this circle. Like even small things, like when the kids, we would gather them every day for a community meeting. The staff were beautiful and the kids loved them, but they would use this big megaphone. All right, everybody sit down. Come on, you know. And by the end, the kids, and there's some amazing circle keepers. I wish I could say it was all me. No, there's some amazing circle keepers in that staff. And the kids would run the circle. They know the check-in. They would introduce guests to circle. They would do appreciations. And that took a long time. But that's how. And then I felt that by modeling it, that was the best way to encourage other people to try it on and to learn, because we're all circle keepers. We just don't call ourselves that, but we all have elements of how we build community that can be enhanced through circle work. So that's kind of how I brought it in with San Francisco. And then I was part of the San Francisco Unified School District. Mm-hmm. They brought it in through the top though.
Yeah.
Ours came in through the groundswell. We worked with 100 schools in Chicago before they adopted it into the Chicago Public Schools. In San Francisco, because it's more progressive, the person who was the president of the Board of Education, they actually introduced it, and then they formed a committee of about 50 people to explore how to bring it into the, so it's kind of, they still involved the school community, but it was very much more like school-based. And in Chicago, the model that I created there was that whenever we did a gathering, each school community, bring young people, bring school people, and bring community people. Because even if a young person is getting kicked out of school, we can't lose that connection with community.
Yeah,
we have to keep that bridge, that net for them, so that they're not falling through the cracks. In San Francisco, it was really more about, and it was powerful, but it was really like very professionalized, very school focused. And I think we got to bring in the security guards, the mom around the corner, who helped found our peer jury was helped. One of the, Chris and Sarah, was a mom around the corner who saw kids coming from school and she didn't like what they were doing. She was very progressive, but she didn't know how to, she saw them doing stuff that was not so cool. But we connected, and she was one of the best trainers around peer jury. And she'd bring her cookies, you know, that she'd make for the kids. But, you know, she was still like very much like training and asking them questions. So like, I think we cannot, professionalized things where people in the community get pushed out, elders get pushed out.
Right. When you're talking about like we all have this way of being and connecting with each other, it may not look like the quote unquote professional textbook tools that, you know, are being taught when things are being implemented from the top. One of the things that I think about a lot is that you can't mandate people to be restorative. You can't mandate this work, right? And when something from the top comes down like that, it's like, well, like, where is the choice? If we value people's humanity, like their choices and the way that they choose to show up is removed. And so as much like, I actually do think it's net positive that restorative justice does get rolled out from the top where there's like administrative support, right? Mm-hmm. But like, I think we do lose something when it's being pushed on people who aren't ready to receive it in that way, yeah, or can't receive it in the way that it's being given, right? Both people who are like very entrenched in and invested in white supremacy culture who are afraid, but also people who know this from know different ways of doing this work. And when you're saying like, this is the one right way to do this work, that also turns people off. And so, yeah, there's a lot in there, and yeah, I'm just happy that we're having this conversation.
And you know, that's why when I started doing circle with my family, mm-hmm. teachers were one of the hardest groups to do circle work because they had been burnt so much. Mm-hmm. And they, like you said, they had so much stuff pushed from on high.
Yeah.
And I think with restorative practices, it's actually infused. It should come from the bottom, the side, underneath, on top. you know, from all the different roles that people play. But I think one thing with family that was really humbling is that, you know, your family, they're not going to mess around. They're going to tell you straight up. And my family is not the Brady Bunch. They went through a lot of trauma, a lot of stuff, a lot of shit. And so when we first started doing Circle, the way that I introduced it was very simple. It's Dad's birthday today. And instead of just eating cake, let's take a moment and let's really share with them how we feel, because this moment won't come again. And so we literally in the front yard right here where I'm sitting, all gathered, and they're like, what's this? And what's this talking space? And yeah, that's not my faith. That's not my religion.
Yeah.
But after a while, they saw why it was a good way to bring us together, and just doing it very respectfully, because I'm not anyone's boss. I'm not there funded. I'm just there. I'm a sister. I'm a daughter. I'm an auntie, and I love them. And I just want to see better for myself and others. And so that was how we started. And we would do it more to celebrate. But then what happened is we started getting used to being in Circle. And so every time we gather, like, we made it a moment to, like, just literally stand in Circle. And they were open to it. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of my family is in recovery around addiction. Mm-hmm. And they understand about the generational healing. But also, what was I going to say? Being in Circle. But then what happened was we started to have really tough things come up. And because we had been in Circle celebrating each other and giving each other props, then we had some bandwidth then to be in Circle on the tough times.
Yeah.
And a little bit more trust. It was still not hunky-dory. It was still not easy. It was scary. But it made a difference.
It makes me think of two things. One, that this work is... not just that repair, right? It's really hard to start from, like, we're going at each other. And now let's be restorative, right? Like, so, like, let's build that relationship so that when we go at each other, because it's inevitably going to happen, we can do it in a good way, right? We know each other. We use the metaphor of the tree a lot. Lots of RJ people use the tree, right? When I talk about it, it's like, you know, the branches of the tree are like a restorative circle, restorative conversation, peer conference. I think they're using conference now instead of jury, right? Mm-hmm. Like those are those practices that are doing the restorative process to get to like the fruit and the leaves of healing, relationships, mm-hmm. accountability. And could you propagate a tree from a branch? Sure, you could. But things are going to go so much better when you have like solid roots and a solid trunk that are supporting those branches to get to that fruit. Like, I'm not saying that it's impossible to like bring in just like a restorative process in the middle of conflict, but it makes it a lot easier when you have that foundation. The other thing that I was thinking, as you were saying that, is like the ways that I have to the extent brought this into my family. And oh man.
What is it? Tell me.
Well, have or have not, right? Because when I first learned this work for my birthday, I was like, okay, y'all, we're going to do a circle. It was more a circle around like everybody is reflecting on like what this year has been for folks. And like really, my brother came to Chicago and I was facilitating with Pam, you know, Pamela Purdy.
Not well.
She had worked with Cheryl and Aura, right? So I was doing a circle training with her, and I was like, yo bro, you gotta come and see this. And so, you know, he participated. And so like my family knows what I do, but like as far as bringing it into our practices, that's been tough. And I think without going into like too many details for, you know, everybody in the world to listen to, I think there's something around like not being emotionally vulnerable, not being used to being emotionally vulnerable. I think my parents did a good job of preparing us to be like quote unquote self-sufficient. But part of that is like not needing to rely on anybody else. And so that's a challenge for me.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you. I was scared. I remember I was so scared, but I was like, people, you'd be surprised what people are crying. They really, sometimes there's this hungering. Like, I remember my dad actually broke the first circle we had. He broke down and cried. Mm-hmm. And he said, but he, I don't know what was in his brain. He didn't, you know, he went to second grade. He was like very violent growing up with my family. And, but he was a hard worker. He had been through a lot, but there was something about sitting down there with, I think because he saw so much hurt come out of things, he wanted something better, but he just didn't know how. So he sat, and when he did it, then everybody else was like, oh, okay, well, Grandpa can cry and show, you know. But it's not going to be rosy-posy, and we've had some really tough ones and times. And but I think it's been... It's been worth it because we've discussed addiction. We've talked about caregiving, transition, all kinds of things. It's given us space now to be able to do that.
That's really interesting. Like, you know how you're saying, like, it's not going to be all rosy, sunshine, yeah, roses, peaches, and cream. When I curate training experiences, right, learning experiences for folks, we do make it like because people have come to the space with intention, there are, yeah, so many good feelings. And I'm just now reflecting on, like, how do we make sure that people are equipped to, like, do this with people who, like, didn't all come to this space to, like,
right,
get all connected, right? There are advantages and disadvantages to living in the world that we're in now, right? We can learn anything with a couple taps on our phone, right? We can learn, like, some of the basics things. But when you're talking about learning a way of being, when Indigenous people, our ancestors, used these practices, it was integrated into, like, all aspects of their daily lives. And now we have, like, a specific time. It's like, okay, now we're living in circle. Now it's circle time, right? Now this is the time where we get to be vulnerable, share, and be interconnected. And then as soon as we leave the space, we're navigating a world that is disconnected, individualistic, and all that. And so it really is such a challenge to bring that circle way of being into all of your interactions. And like you're saying, it's not a magic wand. It's not all roses. No. It's hard work that you need community support for.
Yeah. And one thing, there was an elder one time when we were in the lodge, the sweat lodge. I don't know if you've ever gone in. And so they say, actually, the lodge starts when we leave. When we leave the lodge is when the lodge starts. And it made me think about circle, because actually the circle always started for me just as much when I'm not in circle, because that's where it gets tough, when I want to gossip, when I want to do things in the old way, when I want to beat up on myself and not be authentic, whatever it might be, you know, make choices that might not be so, like, that circle work really starts. And even, like, with family, like, I have to really check myself. Like, right now during the pandemic, we have three sisters that are navigating, four women that navigate around my mom's care. And, you know, some are in recovery around addiction, some of them are in different parts of their lives. And so, like, we meet and we do have check-ins and all that. And sometimes it's not always formal circle, but it's that spirit of metakuyasin. We're all connected, you know, we're all in relationship. And then these days I bring a lot of art into my practice, because it's just, for me, it's just allowing the flow to go on a different level through art. So, yeah.
In all of your years doing this work, what's been, like, an oh shit moment, and, like, what did you learn from it?
Ooh, oh shit moment was when we were working with different youth from different gangs, mm-hmm, and we were doing these peace retreats and bringing youth who were in a place of a lot of pain and still living the street life. I think the oh shit moment was just good intentions are not enough, and really like making sure that you don't take on too much and really make sure you have all the supports needed. And we learned a lot and it was worth it, but it was also knowing your boundaries and knowing, just knowing your boundaries.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah.
How do you want to continue to grow in this work, and like this work as broadly as you want to talk about it?
Yeah. I want to use creativity. I want to be a space for creativity. I want to hold space for creative healing, creative connection. And why creative? Because there's so many things that can be done differently, but unless we see that possibility, sometimes we just keep doing things the same old way, you know, like the saying goes, and you expect different results. I also do a lot of space design. I used to do that in Chicago on the side. I used to declutter and organize space. And I'm very interested in how we create spaces that are healing in a physical way too. You know, like even like a quick example, this is like my mom's 89, and they have done studies that people who have Alzheimer's or dementia, when you have very decluttered space, it actually helps them because they can get around, they maneuver. That's common sense, right? But I'm very intrigued around space, how we create space in community, working with designers, design thinking, how we transform from the inside out, and then don't stop there. Don't stop there, you know, like, why can't we transform communities that are, you know, this is already happening, you know, that are not just based on you got to drive your car, or you don't never know your neighbor, or you have all these fences. So I'm very interested in how creativity can do that. But I think also not the game changer for me is continuing to make at the center of creativity those voices that people don't think are creative. And the voices that are shut down. It's like peer jury. The young people that came together, they were the kids that very diverse, kind of like the Breakfast Club. I think I mentioned that. It was like the quote athletes, the youth who were smart in school, good kids, quote, kids who were bad kids, quote. And they all had different gifts that they brought to the process and different, you know, and but they were able to create something that they had never seen and have enough vision to do that and not give up. Like that squirrely little, the eighth grader, he later on became one of the, when he was a senior, was like this very wise person that he always was, you know. But if you just stop there and like just start, we're like, oh, he's too goofy, you know, he can't. No, that's not what this is about. So I think like these changes have to be made from the roots. I don't say the bottom, the roots, and the people who have been pushed out need to be part of this creative process. They need to be part of owning it. And it can't just be for people who are, quote, educated, who are doing things for us, for them, me doing, you know, I'm including myself too, because, you know, I've made mistakes too. But yeah, like for example, the two caregivers around my mom, the one that has been most dedicated is my sister, who's been in recovery for 5 years. And she came into this process homeless and really, really struggling. And she's still, you know, there's been two relapses, but man, we can sit down and have a conversation and wisdom. And she's so good. She's so good. She has so much to offer. And where's her voice in this process, in this reshaping, in this creative? So that, I think that's the main thing right now, is just like thinking from in to out, but also bigger is not better. But sometimes when you do it for the right reasons, it can't help but get bigger. That's what I find also, like the things that have come from my heart, they've grown. Like quick example was in Tenderloin. It was, I think I shared one of the groups, one of the programs that projects I founded was the Tenderloin Safe Passage. And that just started from a really thing, was that it was hard to walk kids around safely in the neighborhood with so much drama going on. And so we came together and we started walking our kids, and in a way where we weren't putting down or like distancing ourselves from the people who were on the street, because those were aunts, uncles, some of them literally were of the kids and neighbors. And, but we were able, now that program is huge in San Francisco. It's a model in the country, but we didn't do it because we said this is going to be a model for the country. We just did it because we had to think outside the box and reconnect to something different.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's just about meeting community needs. And I think, I have too many conversations. I don't know if we talked about it already today, but like the people who know how to solve their problems are the people who are most affected, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we should always be looking for that. Yeah, that's such a great reminder. I want to transition us into the questions that I ask everyone that are meant to be rapid fire, but aren't always. So restorative justice is?
Life.
You get to sit in circle with four people, dead or alive. Who are they and what do you talk about?
My brother, he was one of the first people to live and die when the AIDS pandemic or the AIDS was happening in San Francisco, very active. He was an artist, also very active in the community. My brother, Xavier Zamora. Probably my father again, who also passed, Rufino Zamora, and probably, I don't know, probably like a, maybe like two ancestors in our family tree that were, from Mexico.
What would you talk about?
I would really have a lot of questions about their lives and who they were. And I think like having them answer honestly, because with my dad, he didn't like to talk about stuff. And I think he tried, but if he would be really open. And then for my brother, I feel like we were kindred spirits, but we had some conversations, but we really never got to go deeply. And whenever I'm in a really tough time in my life, they always come to me in my dream. I don't dream about anybody that's passed, but when I go through a really tough time, my brother and father are always there. For them.
You've shared some of this already, but what is a restorative practice you're leaning into for yourself recently?
I'm on a leadership team with BIPOC women through a place of her own. And I'm really leaning into restorative practice there in terms of this formation that we are creating together.
Yeah.
And really bringing in our vulnerability and strength and trauma in a way that is without shame or guilt, but in a way that is very encouraging and supportive. And really trying to model how we work through things, because it's going to be important for us as we work with other women in the community. So I'm very excited about that because I feel like I'm showing up and the work is happening and I'm healing and I feel supported and it's hard and we have harder conversations and I love it because it feels like the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So I get that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so amazing. What is one thing you wish everyone listening to this podcast would know?
That you are loved. That you really are loved. And to find that source of your 100%. Like, this is my pillow I have. People can't see it. But this was my affirmation in place.
It says 100 in buttons.
But I did this with my great niece, helped me sew these buttons on. And we had a conversation about what it meant to be 100. And I know everybody says 100, but really that don't forget your 100%. And because that gets taken away. And then when we start believing that hurt, you know, then hurting out and just so like just remembering that you are loved, you are loved, you are loved. And how do we embody it? Fania Davis actually spoke this the other day. She was speaking at a National Day of Healing and she just said, in the work that we're coming up with, we have to be about, truly be about what we're wanting to see in the world. And it's just not Fania, there's, you know, be the change you want to see.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Speaking of Fania,
yeah.
Who's one person I should have on this podcast? And, you know, help me out.
Yeah. So wait, this is you're gonna edit this, right?
Sometimes I leave it in, so like you know the universe
can do it.
But I can't take it out if you want me to.
Okay. So yeah, let's say I think Fania Davis, and yeah. I sent out an email, Fania. I don't know if it's your right email, but connecting you with David because he's doing amazing work, and it would be great to hear your wisdom and have you all meet. So I hope that this will get to you. And also I was participating in the National Day of Healing through Our Joy, Restorative Justice for Open Youth. And I got to hear and meet some of the other facilitators. So I'm gonna connect them with David as well. You might already be connected to some of the members right now who are leading Our Joy.
Yeah,
but they definitely know where to find you, Fania, and we would love to hear from you. So, yeah.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. It's been put out.
Yes.
And then finally, how and where can people support you, your work, in the ways that you want to be supported?
Yeah, well, I'm still working on one place you can see some more of my work is A Place of Her Own, Artist Talk, and different exhibits, work that we're doing. I'm also working on my own. You can find me at Patricia A. Zamora, LinkedIn, and you can contact me there, message me about any collaborative efforts and work that you're doing. And I'm still working on my own website, so I don't have anything specific to share at the moment, but those are two good places to start.
Awesome. And we'll have those linked in the description for folks. It was really so great to reconnect with you. I know we just connected a couple weeks ago after my conversation with Sandra, but it is just so good to, you know, get to know you more and be in space. And thank you so much for sharing your stories and your wisdom with all of us.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
All right. Everybody else, we'll talk to you next week. Take care until then.
Elise here. Here are some things that I've pulled away from this episode today. One thought that really stuck with me was the idea of why we do restorative justice. Paz brought up the idea that bigger isn't always better, and that the goal of making things big can often be counterproductive to the actual reasons of why we do restorative justice. Restorative justice is a lifestyle. Restorative justice comes from passion. And with that passion, it can become bigger and it can become a bigger initiative, but it needs to start from passion. What got you interested in restorative justice, and how are you keeping that passion alive? Another thing that she mentioned was that sometimes people aren't ready for restorative justice. How can we introduce restorative justice to those who are not quite ready? Thank you so much for listening today. And just a reminder about our announcements, we have launched our Future Ancestors Collective. We are having our first birthday kickback, and please go check out our YouTube channel. All of the information is in the show notes below. And thank you so much for tuning in this week. I'll see you next week.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. It really helps us further amplify this work. You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, rocking our new merch, joining our Patreon, or signing up for a workshop. So many options! Links to everything in the show notes and on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.